Recently, there's been a thread, a discussion thread on the Definity Developer Forum, focused on the notion of developing an ethos for the internet computer. It's been a really interesting discussion, and there have been a whole bunch of ideas about how what this ethos should be and how to define it and where it applies. Are we talking about an ethos for the Definity Foundation? Are we talking about an ethos for the NNS? Are we talking about an ethos for the internet computer as a whole? The thread has become quite long and hard to read through. So rather than post in that thread, what I thought I'd do is just share a few thoughts in response to what's in that thread and lay out an idea for how we might achieve what seems to be the focus of that discussion. There was an edit to the original post in which the question was raised, how do we define a process for coming up with an ethos? And hopefully here we can kind of lay out an idea for how that ethos might be developed, an idea that makes sense. To respond to some of the drive for identifying an ethos, one commenter noted that Ethereum has an ethos on its website. But if you read that, it's really a bit of fluff. It seems quite marketing-y. It doesn't really have what I would describe as a practical implementation. And it predominantly focuses on the ethos of the foundation itself. And because the ethos discussion is not really clear in where it wants to focus, be that the Definity Foundation, the NNS, or the internet computer in its entirety, it's not necessarily clear that that is relevant to this discussion. However, Ethereum did have a design policy, a protocol design policy back in the day. It was not entirely public, and there were several elements to it. Decentralization was obviously part of it, and we'll get into that in a little bit. One of the design policies was protocol stability. And the reason I raise this is because it's pertinent to understanding what we mean by creating a ethos. The idea of protocol stability was that if we can create something that's extremely stable, that developers can rely on always being the same, it will be more appealing and be stickier. One example of this is the Urbit project that uses a Kelvin versioning system. So they count down from, so let's say version 1000 down to version 0. And the idea of this is that rather than traditional development, software development, where you make additive changes over time, with Kelvin versioning, the goal is to complete the build. So it achieves completion and it's over and there's no more work to be done. That's the idea of Kelvin versioning. And this ethos was part of the original development of the Ethereum protocol. This was displayed quite interestingly in a panel discussion between Vitalik, Jay Kwan of Tendermint and Cosmos, and Dominic. It was run by Martin Koppelman. And at one point, this was in 2017, and in one point, Vitalik made the comment that they don't want to, this was in relation to Threshold Relay, they don't want to rely on unproven cryptography. This was a stupid comment because pairing-based cryptography, which he was referring to, is considered to be proven cryptography. It relies on elliptic curve cryptography, the same type of cryptography that's used to define the public and private keys that we use to control our blockchain assets. The reason that Vitalik didn't want to rely on that was not that it wasn't proven cryptography, in spite of his statements. The reason was, and this is documented somewhere online, it's hard to go back 5 years and dig up some of these online discussions. Because elliptic curve cryptography is not quantum safe, if elliptic curve cryptography was used at the protocol layer rather than at the addressing layer, once we see the proliferation of quantum computing, the underlying protocol layer would have to be changed. And that runs counter to the design policy of achieving protocol stability. So this is an example of balancing design needs against general ethos, and sometimes sacrifices have to be made. Funnily enough, eventually, and again, I'm really stretching my brain here, I believe they did use pairing-based cryptography in the consensus system that powers Ethereum's proof-of-stake engine. So even though initially they didn't want to do this for ethical reasons, or we could call this overarching policy reasons, they had to make a sacrifice against the ethos that they had established in order to achieve proof-of-stake. So this is an example of some of the ways that ethos and overarching policy can become problematic, and if they're defined in advance. Sometimes it's just impossible to know what will work. And this illustrates why listing ideals is problematic. Another issue is that they can lose their meaning over time. Decentralization is a great example, the word decentralization. The idea of decentralization as a strategy for making these systems work has its roots in a bunch of academic theory. Just to simplify things, two schools of thought are relevant are Austrian economics and systems theory. But usually, in the online discussions of decentralization, we don't see references these days to these underlying theories. There was always a reason behind decentralization. It's a strategy to achieve an end. Decentralization is not an end in and of itself. So what is that end? The end is to create a self-organizing complex system. These systems are robust, enduring, open to interaction, which we can also see as inclusive or censorship resistant. They're flexible. Under the right conditions, they self-assemble. So trying to define an ethos for the community in advance is kind of in direct opposition to allowing that community or that group of people or that economy or ecosystem to self-assemble, to build what it naturally wants to build. A little bit about how these things interact. Austrian economics and systems theory. The idea of Austrian economics is firmly rooted in free market theory and the notion that a large group of unrelated actors without any direct coordination can work independently to create a grand edifice, some amazing thing, that some incredible whole. And we see this in today's world, right? That's the economy. The success of capitalism is entirely down to this principle. And so we can say that the Austrian economists were right. It's really worth reading Hayek. If Hayek's a bit crazy, you know, and history is history doesn't really smile on him, but he's absolutely worth reading to understand some of the mindset behind the design of blockchain systems. Once you have this grand edifice, systems theory gives us an understanding of how it behaves and how it works. And so by working with these two theories, we see why decentralization is important. We can also see why Vitalik was so keen on protocol stability. What he was trying to achieve was a protocol that was complete in its ability to allow an entire economy to self-assemble and operate using this protocol as a medium of exchange, identity registry, etc. The goal was to create a substrate for a self-assembling system, a complex system to emerge. And we can argue that they have been successful, even though they have undermined some of the policies, some of the ethos that the original Ethereum team wanted to adhere to. Returning to the edit in the original post on developing an ethos on the Definity Developer Forum, that edit being a desire to come up with a system for developing an ethos or a process for developing an ethos, there is precedent for doing this, and that is policymaking, public policymaking. Although all organizations, all successful organizations tend to, all enduring organizations tend to have policymaking procedures. And to clarify in advance, when I'm saying policy, I mean any hard decision that has to be made. In the case of the internet computer, a policy could be a proposal for the NNS, but the word is more broadly applicable. effective policymaking comes down to three things: research, analysis, and policy synthesis. And policies change with time. An example of this that we can see, and this is with regard to what we could think of as overarching policies or collections of commonly occurring small policies, smaller policies, specific policies, are the free market policy that powered the industrial age and replaced feudalism, which we could also think of as a state policy. After the Great Depression, the collection of policies that we collectively call socialism were adopted because the free market policies that they were replacing had failed the world. And then as socialism failed, we moved back to free market policy with the reemergence of liberalism, which we call neoliberalism. Today, we have growing wealth inequality and related social issues, and we see a emerging conflict between two policy sets, two overarching policies, conservative authoritarianism, and the resurgence of socialism. The reason for this continual change is that we find over time our policies, which make sense at the time we make them, or again, our ethos that makes sense at the time that we produce it, may not be applicable to a situation that we encounter further down the line. In addition, they change the situation we are in such a way that it potentially needs to be adjusted. Our policies need to be adjusted. This is the effects of positive feedback loops, which is probably a whole nother discussion. There are two reasons why policies fail. And those reasons are either they're imperfect. I know, who'd have thought you could produce imperfect public policy or organizational policy? The other reason is special interest influence. Anytime you're trying to create a policy, there are always going to be special interests that attempt to derail the creation of effective policy in their interests. The way that we create good policy in the first place, and the way that we protect ourselves from special interests derailing that policy, is by following rigid, auditable processes for creating policies from which high-quality policy can emerge. And that high-quality policy reflects the most up-to-date thinking accurately applied to well-understood problems. These systems always have a degree of frailty. So anytime that you see public policy being changed, it's always because either the original policy was imperfect or special interests have got involved. An interesting example is tax policy, superannuation policy, and welfare policy. These three policies are deeply interconnected. You can't change one without changing the other two. So if you're doing that, or if we see this happening in a public setting, we know that something is afoot. Either special interests are producing bad policy, or an attempt to fix what was bad policy at the start. Or when I say bad policy, really what I'm probably talking about is policy that, if it wasn't bad when it was created, maybe doesn't apply to our current situation. The situation may have changed, and so a policy change may have to happen. And that situation may itself be a result of that policy. And at the risk of going too off topic, the reason that we see this seesaw between socialism and free market capitalism is because of the interconnection between welfare, tax, and superannuation, as well as all of the other policies like health policy and economic policy that are further connected to these policies. The interconnection is so great that you can't change just one. You have wind up having to rip the plumbing out of the house. And this is the nature of complex systems like economies, societies, and blockchain ecosystems. Francis Fukuyama was an American political philosopher who had this idea that there was a perfect society that would essentially be the end of history. And he associated democratic capitalist nations with that idea. Francis Fukuyama published his book in 1992, But in 2013, Thomas Piketty published his book, Capital in the 21st Century, that theorized a positive feedback loop inherent in contemporary capitalism would lead to societal instability. When return on investment is greater than economic growth, eventually you have out of control wealth centralization, regardless of the rate of growth of an economy. And this would eventually lead to societal instability and failure. And he illustrated this in that book and another one, which he published more recently. So you can see how the commitment to this ethos of free market capitalism made sense in the early 90s. But by the time we got to 2013, the situation had changed and our understanding had changed, and it didn't sound quite so good anymore. And Thomas Piketty's work is the basis for the resurgence of socialism as a plausible theory for how to approach the problems that contemporary societies face. A great example of this actually was the British Prime Minister Liz Truss, now ex-British Prime Minister Liz Truss, her tax policy. So she produced a tax policy that was designed to stimulate the economy. It involved tax cuts for the rich. The World Bank said this sounds terrible. The Reserve Bank of the UK said this sounds terrible. And the British stock market also thought that this sounded terrible. It represented either a misunderstanding of the problem or a misapplication of contemporary theory to the problem. Either way, everyone seemed to disagree, and so Liz Truss was removed from the British Prime Ministership. This is an example of these systems preventing poor policy from being created. A comparable example in the internet computer governance process was the increase and then subsequent decrease of governance policy rewards weighting. And there were elements of poor policy creation from the start, but there were also special interests in the form of neuron holders wanting to that policy to not be changed. So you can see how we do appear to have some kind of robust system in place, even if it is a self-organizing system already in the internet computer community. So let's respond to the question posed in the post: what does a process for creating an ethos look like? And I would argue that we could just convert that question to: what does a process for effective policymaking look like? And how does an ethos or an overarching policy emerge from that? Well, we have to go through a series of steps. And again, I feel like I'm using policy, the word policy, a lot. You can just think of this as making decisions. The first thing we need to do is identify the problem that we're trying to solve and our goals in making a decision to effect change to fix that problem. The second thing we have to do is research. We need to deeply understand the problem and also find applicable theory or other pre-existing knowledge that we can apply to coming up with a solution for that problem. The third stage is policy design or policy synthesis. We apply this well-understood theory to a high-quality understanding, a deep understanding of the problem we're trying to solve. We then assess the externalities, the external effects that this change might have, and we identify interaction risks for future policies. What could happen that would interfere with this policy? We need this. This is like a cheat sheet for future policy creation. Now, we repeat this process continually as we make new decisions, new policies, and we, every time we create a new policy, we check that this does not undermine earlier policies, the motivations behind earlier policies, and the effects of earlier policies. As we do this, an ethos and overarching policies will emerge. And of course, we always start with some unspoken overarching policies. So decentralization is an example, and these guide our thinking. But our goal should always be to make them explicit and highly defined over time. This again is how I feel an ethos can emerge, a process for creating an ethos. An example of some overarching policies that recently came into conflict on the internet computer are a desire for high governance participation, or, you know, maximum governance participation, and ICP token decentralization, or decentralization in general, right? These two came into conflict recently. So returning to the increased weighting of governance proposals and the disabling of default follows by the foundation, this is kind of, we can think of this as one policy, just for the sake of simplicity. Effective research would have told us that some neuron holders would not refollow once their default following had been disabled. This would in turn lead to increased rewards for those that did refollow. So this policy has a centralizing effect ultimately on ICP token ownership. By adopting it, we're accepting that the circumstances under which this policy was developed, some ICP decentralization could be eroded. We were okay with that in favor of increasing governance participation. Returning to the notion of decentralization as an ethos, what this policy decision represents is a defined limitation on the ethos of decentralization. This is the process by which we can create an ethos.